Put Out More Flags by Evelyn Waugh. Dramatized in three parts by Dennis Hawthorne. With Simon Cadell as Basil Seal and Tony Britton as the narrator. Part 3. Spring. The London that Basil Seal returned to in the spring of 1940 was still relatively unaffected by the actuality of the war. Peter Pastmaster, his regiment still standing by, was to be seen escorting a number of eligible girls around the town. Poppet Green and her friends continued to meet at the Café Royal. Ambrose Silk, still the atheist representative in the religious department of the Ministry of Information, enthusiastically set about writing the material for the first issue of his new magazine, The Ivory Tower. And Angela Lyne continued to sit by herself in her flat, listening to the wireless and drinking too much whiskey. It was on none of these, however, that Basil called on his return. He went to see his mother.
I never thought I should have to say this to you, Basil. I'm pleased, of course, that you were able to be of help to Barbara with her evacuees. But now that you're back in London, I must tell you that I do not think it is man's work. At a time like this, you ought to be fighting.
Mother, as far as I know, no one's fighting much at the moment.
Don't quibble, dear. You know what I mean.
Well, I went to see that colonel when you asked me.
Yes, Sir Joseph explained that to me. They only want very young officers in the Guards. But he says that there are a number of other excellent regiments that offer a far better career. General Gordon was a sapper.
A sapper?
I believe quite a large number of generals in this war were originally only gunners. I don't want to see you just lounging about London in uniform like your friend Peter Pastmaster. He seems to spend his whole time with girls.
Really? What girls?
That goose Emma Granchester is thinking of him for Molly. So are Etty Flincher and poor Mrs. Von Andrebus for their daughters. I don't know what they're thinking of.
I must look Peter up.
I want to see you doing something important. Now, Sir Joseph has got me one of the forms you fill in to become an officer. It's called the Supplementary Reserve. Before you go to bed, I want you to sign it. Then we'll see about sending it to the proper quarter.
But, you know, Mother, I don't really fancy myself as a subaltern.
Promotion is very quick in wartime because so many people get killed. I'm sure once you're in, they'll find great use for you.
Thus it was that Basil found himself again in danger of being started on a career, and not one of his choosing. He telephoned Angela's flat several times, but she was not answering the phone. And so, receiving no reply, he assumed that she was not in London and continued to stay with his mother. This left him very exposed to her plans for his future. He fretted about this for 3 days, and then decided to pay a visit to the War Office. He went there without any particular object in view, impelled by the belief that somewhere in that large organization was a goose that would lay eggs for him. In the vestibule of the building were a crowd of uniformed officers of all ranks attempting to gain admission. Among them, Basil saw a single civilian figure, a small, scrubby man carrying a suitcase. He recognized him from his visit to the Ministry of Information some months before.
Hello. Still hawking bombs, are you?
Still trying to, yes. The suitcase is full of bombs. Enough to blow the roof off the building.
Hmm.
But they won't pay any attention. This is a most unsatisfactory office. They won't let me in. I was sent on here from the Admiralty.
Have you tried the Air Ministry?
Why, bless you, it was them that sent me to the Ministry of Information. I've tried them all, but I'm not getting anywhere.
Come along, I'll get you in.
It's not easy, you know. I've seen generals turned away from here.
Good morning, Sergeant.
Good morning, gentlemen. Your passes, please.
Oh, that's all right, Sergeant. I'll vouch for this man.
Yes, sir, but who are you, sir?
Oh, you ought to know by this time. MI-13, we don't carry passes or give names in my department.
Oh, very good, sir. Beg pardon, sir. Do you know the way, or shall I send a boy up with you?
Of course I know the way, and you might take a good look at this man. Hmm? He won't give his name or show his pass, but I expect you'll see him quite often.
Very good, sir.
I'm sure I'm very obliged. Where shall I go now?
The whole place lies open to you. Take your time. Go where you like. I think if I were you, I should start with the Chaplain General.
Where's he?
Up there. Just up there and straight on.
Right. Thank you.
The little man, with his suitcase full of bombs, trotted off down the corridor with the irregular, uncoordinated steps of the insane. Basil took the opposite turning. A fine vista lay before him, of 20 or more closed doors, any one of which might open upon prosperity and adventure. It was full of potentiality, but lacking at the moment in ornament, a vista of marble flooring and solemn dado. The light came solely from the far end, so that a figure approaching appeared in silhouette and in somewhat indistinct silhouette. A figure now approached. And it was not until she was within a few yards of Basil that he realized that here was the enrichment that the austere architectural scheme demanded. A girl, dressed in uniform, a lance corporal's stripe on her arm, with a face of transparent, ethereal silliness, which struck deep into Basil's heart. He waited for her to pass him, and then turned and followed her down the corridor. At length, she halted at a door marked ADDIS, Addis. She went in, and so did Basil.
Well, now you know where I live. Drop in any time you're passing.
What is Addis?
It's Colonel Plum.
What's Colonel Plum?
Oh, he's a perfect lamb. He's also the Assistant Deputy Director, Internal Security. His office is through there.
I think I'd like to come and work here.
Yes, everyone says that. It was the same when I was in pensions.
Susie, you slut, where have you been?
Oh, hello. Who the devil's this?
I don't know. He just followed me in.
Who are you and what do you want?
Well, what the Lance Corporal says is strictly true. I just followed her in. But since I'm here, I can give you some valuable information.
Oh, if you can. You're unique in this outfit. What is it?
Well, can I speak freely in front of the Lance Corporal?
Oh, yes, of course. She doesn't understand a word of any language.
There's a lunatic loose in the War Office.
Of course there is. There are some hundreds of them. Is that all you came to tell me?
He's got a suitcase full of bombs.
Well, I hope he finds his way to the intelligence branch. I don't suppose you know his name.
Ah.
No. Well, make out a car for him, Susie, with a serial number and index him under suspects. Mm. If his bombs go off, we shall know where he is. If they don't, it doesn't matter. Now, get on with that, Susie. Mr. Seal and I are going to retire to the inner sanctum. I want to talk to him.
Have we met before?
You bet we have. Djibouti, 36. Saint-Jean-de-Luz, 37. Prague, 38. You wouldn't remember me. I wasn't dressed up like this then. Take a pew.
Thank you. Were you a journalist?
Sometimes. We got drunk together once at the Bar Basque, the night you fought the United Press correspondent.
Ah. As far as I remember, he won.
You bet he did. I took you back to your hotel. So what are you doing now, besides making passes at Susie?
I thought of doing counter-espionage.
Yes. Most people who come here seem to have thought that. Hello? That sounds as if your man has had a success with his bombs. Well, that was a straight tip anyway. I dare say you'd be no worse in the job than anyone else. What are your contacts?
I know some very dangerous communists.
We aren't doing much about communists at the moment. The politicians are shy of them for some reason, but we keep an eye on them, on the side, of course. I can't pay you much for communists.
Well, as it happens, I came here to serve my country. I don't particularly care about the money.
Oh, well, the devil you don't. What do you want, then? You can't have Susie. She's mine. I had a hell of a fight to get her away from the old brute in charge of pensions.
We can find that out later. What I really want most at the moment is a uniform.
Good God. Why?
My mother's threatening to make me a platoon commander.
Yes. Yes, there's a lot to be said for a uniform. It's the best possible disguise for a man of intelligence. No one ever suspects a soldier of taking a serious interest in war. I think I can fix that.
What will my rank be?
Second Lieutenant, Cross and Blackwell Regiment.
Cross and Blackwell?
General service list.
Well, I say, can't you do better than that?
Not for watching communists. Catch a fascist for me and I'll think about making you a Captain of Marines. Yes? Addis speaking. Oh, yes, the bomb. Yes, we know all about it. Oh, the Chaplain General. Oh, I say, that's bad. Oh, only the Deputy Assistant Chaplain General, yeah. His eyebrows have been blown off. Oh, you'll think he'll recover. Yes, we know all about the man in this branch. We've had him indexed for a long time. He's nuts. Yes, N for nuts, U for uncle. Nuts, you've got it. No, I don't want to see him lock him up. Well, there must be plenty of padded cells in this building, I should imagine.
Peter Pastmaster, in pursuit of his plan to marry and father an heir to the family title, was taking one of his eligible girlfriends to the pictures. In his quest for a wife, Peter had narrowed the field to three. Molly Meadows, Lord Grantchester's second daughter, Sarah, Lord Flintshire's daughter, and Betty, daughter of the Duchess of Steyl. He really could see very little difference between the three girls. In fact, he sometimes caused offence by addressing them absent-mindedly by the wrong names. None of them carried a pound of superfluous flesh. They all had an enthusiasm for the works of Mr. Ernest Hemingway. All had pet dogs of rather similar peculiarities. This evening it was the turn of Molly Meadows. She and Peter were going to see Gone with the Wind, and they joined the queue outside a West End cinema.
No three and sixes, plenty of room in the five and nines. Five and nines this way. Don't block the gangway, please.
I'm told this is terribly good.
Really? I hope so.
They're awfully long.
Five and nines, I want one three and sixes.
No three and sixes, lady.
It isn't the price. Five and nines are too far away.
Peter, that woman at the head of the queue, she has the look of Mrs. Cedric Lyon.
Angela?
Too far away, you see. I want to be near.
Good Lord, you're right. It is Angela.
Please, lady, make up your mind. You're holding the queue up.
What on earth's the matter with
her? Too far away. I can't. Can't see if I'm far away. That's why I...
Oh, oh my God, she's fallen over.
Excuse me. Excuse me, please. I know this lady.
She tripped on the step.
Angela, are you all right? Have you hurt yourself?
Perfectly all right. Not hurt at all, thank you.
Well, get up there.
Peter, I didn't recognise you. Too far away to recognise anyone in the five of ninepennies. Who are you?
Angela, do get up.
How's Margot? I haven't seen her lately. I've been so busy. Well, it's not quite true. As a matter of fact, I've not been altogether well.
What's the matter?
She won't get up.
Then pick up, you coot.
What's going on here?
Come on then, Angela.
Ups-a-daisy.
Lady just fainted. Stand back, please. And you, call a cab.
This key won't fit.
Here, let me.
I thought we were going to the cinema. Wasn't it good?
It was full.
In you go, Angela.
Oh, yes, I remember. The five and nines. Oh, Granger, what are you doing here? I told you I shouldn't want you.
I was worried. You shouldn't have gone out like that. Oh, good evening, Lord Peter.
Evening.
Oh, hello, Peter. Come in. Hello, my dear. You know, I'm sure I should know you quite well, but I can't remember your name.
Molly Meadows. We just came to see you home.
Granger, Mrs. Lyon isn't at all well.
Oh, how old that sounds. You're very pretty, Molly, and you're wearing a lovely dress.
Thank you.
Oh, dear, I must sit down. Peter, help yourself to something to drink. My dear Molly, isn't it? I don't think you've seen my flat. I had it done up by David Lennox just before the war. People say unkind things about David Lennox now. Well, you can't blame them. There's a portrait of me by John, 10 years ago nearly, done when I was married. These are my books. My dear, I'm afraid I'm rather distray this evening. You must forgive me. Three and six, five and nines. Too near. Can't see.
I say she's passed out.
No, she's just asleep. Had we better get her to bed?
When she wakes up, I shall be here. I can manage.
Sure?
Quite sure.
Well then, Peter, I think we'd better go.
Granger, has Mrs. Lyon been out this evening to a party or anything?
Oh, no, my lord. She's been in all day.
Alone?
Quite alone, my lord.
Extraordinary thing. Well, come on, Molly. Good night, Granger. And take care of Mrs. Lyon. I think she ought to see a doctor.
I'll take care of her.
Good night.
I'm awfully sorry about all this.
I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Well, it was certainly rum.
Very rum.
You know, if it had been anyone else but Angela, I should have thought she was tight.
Darling, she was plastered.
What?
Plastered.
Are you sure?
My dear stinko paralytico.
Well, I don't know what to think. It certainly looked like it, but Angela... Besides, her maid said she had been out all evening. Now, I better get hold of Basil. I mean to say, people don't get tight alone.
Oh, Peter. Peter. Bless you.
I
don't want to go back to the cinema. I'm suddenly very hungry. Let's have dinner instead. Oysters. Only a dozen. nothing else.
Certainly, madame.
Thank you.
Were you surprised when I kissed you?
No, certainly not. Not at all.
Not at all? You mean to say you expected me to?
No, of course not. You know what I mean.
You certainly don't. I think it's very conceited of you not to be surprised. Do you always have this effect on girls? Or is it just the uniform?
Oh, Molly, don't be a beast. If you must know, I was surprised.
And shocked?
No, just surprised.
Yes, I was surprised too.
Oh, really, Molly, I don't understand you tonight.
Oh, but you must. Really, Peter, you must. I'm sure you were a fascinating little boy.
Come to think of it, I think I was.
You mustn't ever play the old rip again, Peter. Not with me, at any rate. Well, now, don't pretend you don't understand that. I like you puzzled, Peter, but not absolutely cretinous.
I say.
You know, I nearly despaired of you tonight. You would go on bucking about what a gay dog you'd been, and about Alistair and Sonia and Basil and what fun you all had, but that how that was all over now.
Well, I hope so. Yes, I hope so.
I thought I could never go through with it.
Through with what?
Marrying you. Mother's terribly keen, I should. Though I can't think why. I should have thought from her point of view you were about the end. I knew Lady Metrolin very little, she says. I'm afraid she was always too smart for us.
Smart?
I don't think she meant it as a compliment. But she's determined I should marry you. So I've tried to be good and I've let you bound away about the good old days till I thought I should have to pour something on your head. I thought I couldn't bear it anymore and I decided to tell Mother it was off. Then we met Mrs. Lyon, and everything was all right.
Well, that whole carry-on with Angela seemed awfully awkward to me.
Of course it did. Oh, you looked like a little boy at his private school when his father had come to the sports in the wrong kind of hat. An adorable little boy.
Well, I suppose as long as you're satisfied.
Yes, I think satisfied is the word. You'll do. And Sarah and Betty will be as sick as cats.
Yes?
It's me, Mother.
Oh, Peter. Hello, darling.
I thought you'd better know. Molly Meadows and I...
Yes?
We're engaged.
Oh, good. I am glad. How did you decide?
Well, as a matter of fact, I don't think I did. Molly decided.
Oh, yes, that's usually the way. Now I shall have to do something friendly about that arse Emma Grantchester.
We ran into Angela tonight.
Oh, I didn't know she was in London. How was she?
Very under the weather, I thought.
Oh, really?
I think I'd better get a hold of Basil.
Peter was here the other evening with some girl. I suppose they've told everyone.
You told me. If you're going to drink like this, you should switch to rum. Much better for you than whiskey.
Is it? I don't think I've ever tasted rum. Should I like it?
Well, since I'm round, you look awful.
Yes, darling, I feel awful. You're in the army.
No, the war office. When did you start on this bat?
Oh, weeks ago.
Not a bit like you.
Isn't it, Basil? Isn't it?
Always bloody to me when I went on a bat.
Yes, I suppose I was. But then, you see, I was in love with you.
Was?
I don't know. Fill up the glasses, Basil.
That's the girl.
Was is wrong. I do love you, Basil.
Of course you do. Is that how you take it?
That's how I take it.
Good and strong.
Good and strong.
But I think we'd be better suited to rum.
Doesn't it smell rather?
Don't see that that matters.
Don't want to smell.
Whiskey smells.
Well, I suppose it doesn't matter. It's nice drinking with you, Basil.
Of course it's nice. I think it's pretty mean of you to drink without me, as you've been doing.
I'm not mean.
You usedn't to be. You have been lately, haven't you? Drinking by yourself.
Yes, that was me.
Now, listen. Next time you want to go on a bat, let me know. Just ring me up and I'll come round. Then we can drink together.
But I want to so often, Basil.
Well, I'll come round often. Promise me?
I promise.
That's the girl.
The rum was a failure. But in general, the arrangement worked well. Angela drank a good deal less and Basil a good deal more than they had done for the last few weeks, and both were happier as a result. And when, a few weeks later, they went to Peter and Molly's wedding, everyone commented on how smart and how well they both looked. They spent most of the time talking to Sonia, who was pregnant. Alistair was still in barracks at Brookwood and hadn't been able to come to the wedding. Later on, they went back to Angela's flat.
That's an unusually good girl Peter's picked for himself. You ought to marry someone like that.
I never marry anyone. Except perhaps you.
No, I don't believe you could, Basil.
Here you are.
Thanks. I seem to be getting to the age when I enjoy weddings. Do you know who was here this morning? Cedric.
How very odd.
It was very touching, really. He came to say goodbye. He's off tomorrow. He couldn't say where, but I guess it's Norway. I never thought of him as a soldier somehow, but he used to be one until he married me. A very bad one, I believe. Poor Cedric, he's had a raw deal.
Well, he's not done so badly. He's enjoyed himself messing about with his buildings and his books. And he's got his son.
He brought Nigel with him this morning. They gave him a day off school to say goodbye. You never knew Cedric when I married him. He was most romantic, genuinely. I'd never met anyone like him. Father's friends were all hard-boiled and rich. They were the only people I ever saw. And then I met Cedric, who was poor and very, very soft-boiled and tall and willowy and very unhappy in a boring, smart regiment.
I didn't know he'd been a soldier.
Orders from his father. He gave him a tiny allowance on condition he stayed in the army. It was either that or a city office. Poor Cedric. All he cared about was the Russian ballet and Baroque architecture. It was all right at first. I had lots of money. We had Nigel. And then I met you.
Oh, let's face it, darling. It wouldn't have lasted, even if I hadn't come along.
No, it wouldn't have lasted. I'm afraid the visit this morning was rather a disappointment to him. I had such a hangover. I had to keep my eyes shut all the time he was here. He's worried about what will happen to Nigel if he gets killed.
Oh, why should he get killed?
Why, indeed. Except he was such a bad soldier. You know, when the war started, I quite made up my mind you were for it.
Yes, so did my mother. But I'm taking care of that, which reminds me, I ought to go see Colonel Plum again. He'll be getting restive. I'll go along now.
Will he be there?
Never leaves. Very conscientious officer. Whoops.
Where have you been? And what have you been doing?
You think I've been drinking, don't you?
I bloody well know you have.
I've been following up a very interesting trail, and I hope to have some valuable information very soon.
What have you got up to date?
You wouldn't sooner wait until I can give you the whole case cut and dried?
No.
I'm on to a very dangerous woman who calls herself Green. Mm-hmm. Among her intimates, she's known as Poppet. She pretends to be a painter, but you only have to look at her work to realize it's a cloak for other activities. Her studio is a meeting place for a communist cell. She has an agent in the United States named Parsnip. He has the alias of Pimpernel. He puts it about that he's a poet. Two poets, in fact. But there again, the work betrays him. Would you like me to quote some Parsnip to you?
No.
I have reason to believe that Green is the head of an underground organization by which young men of military age are smuggled out of the country. Those are the lines I've been working on. What do you think of them?
Rotten.
Yes, I was afraid you might say that. It's your own fault. Give me time. I'd have come up with a better story.
No. You can do some work. Here's a list of 33 addresses of suspected fascists. Check them out.
Now?
No.
Well, shall I keep track of the woman, Green?
Not in office hours.
Well, I know she's used to be found in the evenings.
That's your affair.
Susie, would you like to come and have a drink?
Sorry, handsome. I'm going out to dinner.
With Plum?
Yes.
Must do something about that. Great mistake.
I think you're drunk.
Drunk from chivalry. Hello, Poppet. How are you?
Oh, it's you. So, you're in the army now?
No, the great uniform bureaucracy. How are all the Reds?
Oh, very well, thank you. Watching your imperialists making a mess of your war.
Been to any communist meetings lately?
Why?
Just wondering, Poppy, just wondering.
You sound like a police spy.
Well, that's the very last impression I want to make.
I'm sure.
Seen Ambrose lately?
He's over there, lousy fascist.
Did you say fascist?
Oh, didn't you know? He's gone to the Ministry of Information and he's bringing out a fascist magazine next month.
How very interesting.
It's called The Ivory Tower.
Tell me some more, Poppy.
Don't tell me you're having reservations, Geoffrey. As far as I am concerned, the Ivory Tower is complete. It is ready to be published.
Yes, yes, of course. There is one criticism I foresee. The entire issue seems to have been written by yourself.
Well, no one's going to guess that. If you like, we'll put some pseudonyms in. I've always been rather good at aliases.
It's all very controversial. You've taken on the General Staff, War Cabinet, J.P. Priestley. Even poor old David Lennox comes in for a trimming. It's pretty strong, sir.
Sacred Cows and Whited Sepulchres, Jeffrey. Now that would make a good subtitle for the first section. Whited Cows and Sacred Sepulchres.
I thought you meant it to be a purely artistic paper. Divorced from
we
politics.
Must show people where we stand. Art will follow. Anyway, there's Monument to a Spa.
Yes, there's that.
It's more than half the magazine. 50 pages, my dear. All pure art.
I grant you that.
I wrote it 2 years ago. After I came back from Munich. After parting with Hans. When I read it again, I cried. Publishing Hans' story is a symbolic action, Geoffrey. I am ridding myself of an emotional burden that I have carried for far too long. It's all there, as I remember it. Hans, affectionate, sentimental, guilty. Hans, credulous, giving his simple, his generous acceptance to all the nonsense of Nazi leaders. Singing with his Hitler Youth comrades, joining the brown shirts, marching into Poland, still singing his songs, still faithful to his friend. And then his stormtrooper comrades find that his friend is a Jew. The mob, the hunting pack, fall on that friend.
Yes, quite splendid. The best thing
and
I've
done. And the end, Geoffrey? My flight back to England by train and Hans's fate, whatever it may have been. I suspect the worst. His fate at the hands of those racist, those godless Nazi butchers, against whom we must unite. Against whom the whole world must now unite.
Yes, that's very strong. The end is very strong.
Well, quite frankly, Geoffrey, I regard this as a major work of art.
Yes, Ambrose, I know you do. So do I. I only wish we were publishing it without all that controversial stuff in the first part. I think it's a good idea, pseudonyms for those articles. Do think some up.
The next day, Basil, his interest stimulated by Poppet's attacks on Ambrose, decided to call at the Ministry of Information. The magic formula of MI-13 saw him through to the religious department without let or hindrance. He found the office empty. That afternoon, a film was showing in the Ministry Theatre. It dealt with otter hunting and was designed to impress neutral countries with the pastoral beauty of English life. The religious department were all keen filmgoers, hence the deserted room. On Ambrose's table lay two sets of galley proofs of the ivory tower. Basil pocketed one of them. There was also a passport. Basil took it up with interest. He had never seen an Irish passport before. It was made out for a Father Flanagan, S.J., professor of Dublin University. The photograph showed a cadaverous face of indeterminate age. Basil took this, too. An additional passport often came in useful. At home, at his mother's, he read the proofs carefully, marking a passage here and there. The style throughout was homogeneous, but the author's names were multiform. Ambrose had rather let himself go on the pseudonyms. Huckleberry Squib, Bartholomew Grass, Tom Barebones Abraham. Only Monument to a Spartan bore Ambrose's own name. Later that evening, Basil called on Ambrose in his Bloomsbury flat.
I especially like these proofs back. I've been reading your magazine.
So it was you. Ah, I thought one of those nasty Jesuits had stolen them. They flap in and out of the department like jackdaws. What do you think of it?
Well, I think you might have made it a bit stronger, you know. What you want to do is to shock people a bit. That's the way to put a new magazine across. Suppose you had a little poem in praise of Himmler. Oh, something like that.
I do not believe that that would be a good idea. Besides, as far as I know, no one's written a poem like that.
I guess I could rake one up for you.
Ah, no. What did you think of Monument to a Spartan?
Your piece? Well, all the first part is first grade. Is there anything to drink?
Of course. Whiskey?
Haven't got any rum.
Yes, I have. sailor's tipples. The first part. I suppose they made you put on the ending.
Who?
The Ministry of Information. No water, I take it straight.
They had nothing to do with it. Here you are.
Thanks. Bottoms up. Well, of course, you know best. I can only say I reached for an outsider. What I felt was, this is a first-class work of art, something no one but you could have written, and then suddenly degenerates into mere propaganda.
Propaganda?
Yes, all that stuff about the mob, the hunting pack, Nazi butchers against whom we must unite, the world must unite. Jolly good propaganda, of course. Only wish half the stuff your ministry turns out was half as good. But propaganda, an atrocity story.
Atrocity story?
Yes, you know what I mean, Ambrose. Sort of stuff American journalists turn out by the ream. It glares a bit, you know. Still, of course, we all have to make sacrifices in wartime. You don't think I don't respect you for it, but artistically, Ambrose, it's shocking.
Is it? Is that how it reads?
Leaps to the eye, old boy. Still, I want to give you a leg up in the department.
Well, if I thought that was how people would take it, I'd scrap the whole thing.
Oh, I shouldn't do that. First 45 pages are grand. Why don't you leave it there? With Hans still full of his illusions, marching into Poland behind the swastika.
Well,
and you can bring Himmler in, just at the end, as kind of apotheosis of Nazism.
No.
Well, Himmler isn't necessary. Just leave Hans with his stormtrooper comrades, relishing the first exhilaration of victory.
I shall think about it. Do you really mean that intelligent readers would think that I was writing propaganda?
Well, I couldn't do anything else, old boy. Could they? When does it go to the printers?
Week after next.
Well, still time to toughen the whole thing up, isn't there? You know, this is a very nice flat, Ambrose. Very nice indeed. This is awfully good rum. Got any more?
This magazine seal, the ivory tires, not on sale yet, is it?
No, sir, that's an advance copy.
How did you get hold of it?
I simply went out to the printers and asked for it. Official publication is next Monday.
Well done.
Have you read the passages I marked?
Indeed I have. The article ridiculing the army in the war cabinet by Huckleberry Squibb and this Bartholomew Grass's attack on J.B. Priestley. I know, Jack.
Mm.
Then we have Barebones Abraham, the artist's duty of non-resistance.
You've read Monument to a Spartan?
Indeed I have. Marching into Poland with their flags held high, their songs move them forward with victory in the sky. It's a Nazi bloody hymn. We're on to something here, Seal. I'm going to take this round to Scotland Yard. Ambrose Silk we know about. Smart Jewish left wing, clever cover that. But the others, Bartholomew Grass, Huckleberry Squibb, and Barebones Abraham. He's a Nazi in a woodpile, I'm sure.
Don't you think they sound like pseudonyms?
Nonsense. When a man chooses an alias, he calls himself Smith or Brown.
Have it your own way, sir. I should be interested to see these people in the dock.
There won't be any dock. We'll get this lot under a special warrant.
Well, I'll come to Scotland Yard with you.
No, you won't. You stay here and mind the shop. And keep your hands off Susie. Mm-hmm. See you later, slut. We're on a winner.
Have we really caught some fifth column at last?
I don't know about we. I have.
Will they be shot?
Not all of them, I should think.
Oh, seems a shame, really. I expect they're only a bit touched.
Tell me, Susie, do we ever get to investigate nightclubs? I'm sure they're bursting with enemy agents.
I do. You don't.
We must do something about that. The Colonel told me to mind the shop until he gets back. Show me how to do it.
That pleases Punch at Scotland Yard, rounding out some very handsome bouquets. The whole thing is buttoned up, special warrants for all four of them.
Four?
The man Silk will be arrested tomorrow morning at the Ministry of Information. No problems there. What we need now are descriptions of the other three. We've nothing on them so far, so we know they're clever devils. Squibb, Grass, and Barebones Abraham. He's a joker in the pack, I'm sure of that. Scotland Yard is with me. Get on to that at once, Seal. I'm going to see the Home Secretary.
One thing, sir.
What is it?
I think, sir, you promised to make me a captain of Marines if I caught a fascist.
I said I think about it.
I've caught your fascist, according to you, four.
I'll think about it next time. Remind me. Come on, Susie. I'm off to see the Home Secretary. Straighten your seams and come with me. Seal can look after the shop.
Plum's response to his coup displeased Basil. In the first place, the Colonel seemed to be getting all the credit and all the fun. It was he himself, Basil felt, who should be going to see the Home Secretary. He should have been to Scotland Yard. He should have had the handsome bouquets of which Colonel Plum had spoken. It was not for this that he had planned the betrayal of an old friend. Colonel Plum was putting on altogether too much dog. He made a phone call.
Ambrose? Basil here. Listen, I haven't much time, nor have you. We need to meet. Your flat tonight, late. Don't go out. Wait for me. The signal will be 3 knocks, pause 2 knocks. I can't say any more. Be there.
Now, what is this all about, Basil? Is this one of your cloak-and-dagger games?
It's no game, believe me. We have no time to spare. The police may be here at any moment.
Please, what are you talking about, Basil? This is London. We are not in Germany or Russia.
At the moment, as far as you're concerned, it's both. I've brought you this.
What is it?
A clerical collar. A priest's collar. And a black clerical vest. Adjustable.
A priest?
Yes, and this is an Irish passport. You are Father Flanagan, returning to Dublin University. Once you're in Ireland, you'll be saved.
Ireland?
There's a train at 8 from Euston in the morning. You mustn't be found here. You can sit in the waiting room until it comes in. Have you got a breviary?
Of course not.
Then read a racing paper. I suppose you've got a dark suit.
But yet, what have I done? Why are they after me?
Your magazine. It's being suppressed.
What?
They're rounding up everyone connected with it.
But Basil...
Barebones Abraham, in the ivory tower, your own journal. The artist's birthright is the condition of being perpetually moved on.
Did I say that?
Barebones Abraham. Hurry, Ambrose.
Yes, of course. How did you hear about it?
In the War Office. Believe me, it's true.
But what am I to do with all this? My furniture, my books, my flat.
Look, I'll tell you what, Ambrose. I'll move in and take care of it until it's safe for you to return.
Oh, would you really, Basil?
Of course.
You're being very kind.
Hurry up and get changed.
My God, yes. And I have to pack.
One case, the smallest you have, black if possible.
I must have some clothes.
You are an Irish priest, Ambrose. What do you think the customers are going to say when they open a trunk full of charvet ties and crepe de chine pyjamas? Hurry, man. So far, so good. I think you'd better avoid the waiting room. You never know who might be snooping around.
Right.
Keep out of sight until the train comes in. If anyone speaks to you, tell your beads.
I haven't got any beads.
Then contemplate. Go into an ecstasy, but don't open your mouth or you're done for.
I shall write to you when I get to Ireland.
Better not. Good luck.
Ambrose entered the blacked-out gloom of Euston Station. A few soldiers slept on benches, surrounded by their kit and equipment. Ambrose found a corner darker even than the general gloom. Here, on a packing case that by its smell seemed to contain fish of a sort, he sat, waiting for dawn. Black hat perched over his eyes, black overcoat wrapped close about his knees, mournful and black eyes open, staring into the blackness. From the fishy freight below him, water oozed slowly onto the pavement, making a little pool, as though of tears. The next morning, the police raided the Ministry of Information. When it was explained to them that Ambrose was unaccountably absent from duty, they made their way to Mr. Bentley's office.
Well, yes. Yes, I do remember Ambrose speaking of a magazine he wanted to edit. The Ivory Tower, was it?
Yes, sir.
And I think I did offer him some facilities. Not through the Ministry, of course, but under the aegis of my own publishing house. It was entirely Ambrose's affair. I had no idea it had been printed.
Really, sir?
Well, I'm so busy here. I have almost nothing to do with publishing these days. I'm preparing a series, What Are We Fighting For? Indeed, Inspector, a contribution from you would be most valuable. Law and order undercover, a policeman speaks. That sort of thing? Would you be interested?
I'd have to talk to my superior, sir.
Of course.
Oh, well, sir, it looks as if your friend, Mr. Silk, has fled.
Dear me.
But there are other names connected with this publication, sir, other contributors. You may know something of them.
I suppose it is possible I may have met them in the old days in literary circles, you know.
Barebones Abraham?
Barebones Abraham. Barebones Abraham. Rather a small man, I think, and corpulent. Fat, even. Yes, I remember now. He speaks with a stammer and drags his left leg, rather.
Left leg. Good, very good, sir. And Huckleberry Squib?
Well, yes, he and Barebones Abraham were always together, inseparable. Squib is very tall, quite young, was a sailor once, lost his right ear and wears a gold earring in his left. What was the other name?
Left ear. A Bartholomew Grass.
No, I'm afraid not. Though, I can't be sure of this, but I have a feeling that it may be the pseudonym for a woman.
A woman?
I can't swear to it.
You have been a great help, sir. Well, we shall get these descriptions circulated without delay.
This is a great shock, you know. Ambrose Silk was a personal friend, as well as being a colleague here in the MRI.
One can't be too careful, sir.
I realize that now. A lesson learnt.
Oh, you're looking at this bust, Inspector.
And, of course, you recognize it. Yes, it is George III.
Of course, sir.
The distant kinsman on my mother's side.
Indeed, sir.
The Bentleys have ever been close to the monarchs of England. In a very minor capacity, of course, but the tie has never been broken. Our loyalty has never been called in question.
The next afternoon, Basil was summoned to the office of the Director of Internal Security.
We were clearly onto a very dangerous set of men, Seal, and they've slipped through our fingers.
Yes, sir.
Silk has disappeared. As for the others, we have detailed descriptions of them, thanks to Bentley. But I have no doubt that all four at this moment are sitting in a German submarine laughing at us.
You could be right, sir.
Bentley is above suspicion. He's a member of the royal family. Did you know that?
No, sir.
Oh, he doesn't brag about it. Now, as I understand it, you were the first man to get onto this gang. Have you any idea how they were warned?
You put me in a very difficult position, sir.
Come, come, my boy. No time for petty loyalties when your country's future is at stake.
Well, sir, I feel for some time that there's been too much feminine influence in our department. Have you seen Colonel Plum's secretary?
Hokey pokey, eh?
You could call it that, sir.
Enemy agent?
No, sir. No question of that. But she's a pretty, frivolous, talkative girl. Colonel Plum's intimate...
Yeah, I think I understand. You did perfectly right to tell me.
May I put something to you, sir?
Well, of course, Cecil. Go right ahead.
Where's the colonel?
The director sent for him.
Really? I wonder why.
Where have you been?
I rather think I've been arranging promotion for you.
Oh, you are sweet.
And I'm moving into a new flat.
Oh, lucky you.
I wish you'd come and advise me about the decoration. I'm no good at that kind of thing.
And what would Colonel Plum have to say?
From now on, I don't imagine Colonel Plum will have much to say at all.
Promotion for me.
It's any time to shut up shop, as our absent colonel would say. Plum won't be back for some time. Come and have a drink.
Ambrose, his clerical disguise discarded, settled in a small hotel hidden in a valley of the Wicklow Hills, south of Dublin. Here, he told himself, he would write a book through which he would take up again the broken fragments of his artistic life. He spread foolscap paper on the dining room table, and the soft, moist air settled on it, so that when, on the third day, he sat down to make a start, the ink spread and the lines ran together, leaving what might have been a brushstroke of indigo paint where there should have been a sentence of prose. Ambrose laid down the pen, and because the floor sloped where the house had settled, it rolled down the table, and down the floorboards, and under the mahogany sideboard, and lay there among napkin rings, and small coins and corks, and the sweepings of half a century. And Ambrose wandered out into the mist and the twilight, stepping soundlessly on the soft green turf. In London, Basil set Susie to work. She wanted to be taken out in the evenings too often and in too expensive a style. He set her to work with needle and silk and embroidery scissors, unpicking the A's from the monograms on Ambrose's crepe de chine underclothes and substituting in their place a B.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. The BEF, with their French allies, are fighting a desperate battle in the northern zone of the Western Front. They have withdrawn some miles towards the coast, a movement which has been carried out in perfect order and under cover of strong rearguard actions.
Days and nights, ships of all kinds have plied to and fro across the channel under the fierce onslaught of the enemy's bombers, utterly regardless of the perils, to bring out as many as possible of the trapped BEF.
Now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
Summer came, and with it the swift sequence of historic events which left all the world dismayed and hardly credulous. Finally, it was plain, even to Sir Joseph Mannering, that in the space of a few days England had lost the entire stores and equipment of her regular army, and with the fall of France, her only ally. Her cities lay open to air attacks from fields closer to home than the extremities of her own islands. Her sea routes were threatened from a dozen new bases. Confronted with these facts, Sir Joseph was optimistic.
Seen in the proper perspective, I regard this as a great and tangible success. Germany set out to destroy our army and failed. We have demonstrated our invincibility to the world. Moreover, with the French off the stage, the last obstacle to our proper understanding with Italy is now removed. As you know, Cynthia, I never prophesy, but I am confident that before the year is out, Italy will have made a separate and permanent peace with us.
You're such a comfort, Joe. Do help yourself.
Thank you, Cynthia. The Germans have wasted their strength. They cannot possibly repair their losses. They have squandered the flower of their army. They've enlarged their boundaries beyond all reason and given themselves an area larger than they can possibly hold down. I tell you, Cynthia, the war has entered into a new and more glorious phase.
Ah.
Yes, a new and more glorious phase.
In this last statement, perhaps for the first time in his long and loquacious life, Sir Joseph approximated to reality. He had said a mouthful. Cedric Lyne's regiment had arrived in Normandy and found itself at once engaged in conflict. It was a little battle, but it was a battle. The aeroplanes sang in the morning sky. The little black bombs tumbled out, turning over in the sunlight, drifting behind the machines, breaking in silent upheavals of rock and dust, which were already subsiding when the sound of the explosions shook the hillside where Cedric was standing. The enemy were expected to appear late that afternoon. Battalion headquarters had lost contact with A Company, and Cedric had been sent to relay orders to them. He ran down the hill and began to cross the valley towards their position. The noise began to build up until it became constant and shattering. But it did not seem real to Cedric. It had nothing to do with him. It was part of a crazy world where he was an interloper. He thought of architecture and scholarship, the worlds to which he belonged. He thought of his son, Nigel, of the day they had spent together in London before the regiment had left, of the visit they had made to Angela, of how unsatisfactory it had been, of how he had felt like an interloper there as well. He thought of Angela and their marriage, which after the birth of Nigel had so quickly become a non-marriage. A bomb came whistling down. It seemed from directly over his head. He fell on his face and it burst 50 yards away, bruising him with a shower of small stones. He got up and ran forward. I suppose I'm being rather brave, he thought. How very peculiar. I'm not in the least brave, really. It's simply that the whole thing is so damned silly. He started to run more quickly, almost beginning to enjoy the sensation of the firm ground under his feet and the cool wind on his face, when a stray bullet got him, killing him instantly. Angela received the news by official telegram.
I knew we needed a death to make the war real. I never thought it would be his.
Do you want to marry me?
Yes, I think so. Neither of us can marry anyone else, you know.
That's true.
You'd like to be rich, wouldn't you?
Will anyone be rich after this war?
If anyone is, I shall be. If no one is, I don't suppose it matters so much being poor.
I don't know that I want to be rich. I'm not acquisitive, you know. I only enjoy the funnier side of getting money, not having it.
Anyway, it's not an important point. The thing is, we aren't separable anymore.
Let nothing unite us but death. You always thought I was going to die, didn't you?
Yes.
The dog it was that died. I shall be a terrible husband.
Yes, darling, don't I know it. But you see, one can't expect anything to be perfect now. In the old days, if there was one thing wrong, it spoiled everything. From now on, for all our lives, if there's one thing right, the day is made.
That sounds like
Ambrose in his Chinese mood.
Alistair Trumpington's battalion suddenly got orders to move to an unknown destination. Everyone believed this meant foreign service, and a great breath of exhilaration inflated the camp at Brookwood. After a nighttime of broken train journeys, the battalion found itself quartered in what had once been an unsuccessful holiday camp, on the outskirts of a small south coast seaside resort. They were charged with the defence of this town and some 7 miles of inviting neighbouring beaches, and immediately set about the work of destroying the local amenities. Sonia, in response to a telephone call from Alistair, had arrived in the town and taken rooms in the hotel.
I don't believe you're enjoying the army anymore.
It isn't that. I feel I could be doing something more useful.
But, darling, you told me your mortar was one of the key points of the defence.
So it is.
Well, then.
Sonia, would you think it bloody of me if I volunteered for special service?
Dangerous.
I don't suppose so, really. Very exciting. They're getting up special parties for raiding. They go across to France and creep up behind Germans and cut their throats in the dark.
Sounds like something out of Chums.
Well, yes, I suppose it is, really.
Not much of a time to leave a girl in the Pudding Club, but I can see you want to.
They have special knives and Tommy guns and knuckle dusters. They wear rope-soled shoes.
Bless you.
I heard about it from Peter Passmaster. A man in his regiment is raising one. Peter's got a troop in it. He says I can be one of his section commanders. They can fit me up with a commission, apparently. They carry rope ladders round their waists and have files sewn in the seams of their coats to escape with. Do you mind very much if I accept?
No, darling. I couldn't keep you from the rope ladder. Not from the rope ladder, I couldn't. I see that.
Peter Pastmaster and the colonel of the Special Operations Force set about making their plans in Bratz Club. High on their list of priorities was the selection of officers.
I've had a letter from a man who says he's a friend of yours.
Name?
Basil Seal.
Basil?
You do know him?
Indeed, I do. Does he want to join?
Yes, is he all right?
Perfect. A tough nut.
Right. I'll put him down with Alistair Trumpington as your other section commander.
Oh, no, for God's sake, don't do that. Make him liaison officer.
Basil Seal, liaison officer.
Most of the war seems to consist in hanging about. Might at least hang about with one's own friends.
You see, I know everything about you.
There's one thing you don't know. If you really want to be a widow again, we'd better marry quick. I don't think I told you I'm joining a new racket.
Basil, what?
Very secret.
But why?
Well, you know, things haven't been quite the same at the War House lately. It's not what it used to be. Besides, you know, that racket was all very well in the winter when there wasn't any real war. It won't do now. There's only one serious occupation for a chap now, and that's killing Germans. I have an idea. I shall rather enjoy it.
In Lady Seal's house, the windows were open on the balcony, and the view through the trees to Belgrave Square was placid and unchanged by the events of the past year. Sir Joseph Mannering poured himself another sherry and looked on the lunchtime summer.
Basil's left the War Office.
As you know.
Sir Joseph said this with a sinking heart. Here it was again, the old business. The news from all over the world might be highly encouraging, and poor Booby, he believed it was. We might have a great new secret weapon, and poor Booby, he thought we had. He might himself enjoy a position of great trust and dignity. Poor Booby, he was going that afternoon to address a drawing-room meeting on the subject of hobbies for the ATS. But in spite of all this, Basil was always with him, a grim memento mori staring him out of countenance.
He has joined a special corps d'élite that's being organised. They're going to do great things.
He has actually joined?
Oh, yes.
There's nothing I can do to help him.
Dear Joe, always so kind. No, Basil has arranged it all himself. I expect his splendid record at the War Office helped. It isn't every boy would settle for a life of official drudgery when everyone else was going out for excitement, like Emma Granchester's silly girl in the fire brigade. No, he did his duty where he found it, and now he's getting his reward. I'm not quite sure what they're going to do, but I know it's very dashing and may well have a decisive effect on the war.
The grim moment was past. Sir Joseph, who had not ceased smiling, now smiled with sincere happiness.
I've always thought there was plenty of good in the boy.
I think I'll join you in another sherry.
No, of course, of course.
Here you are, Cynthia.
Thank you, Joe.
There's a new spirit abroad. I see it on every side.
And, poor Booby, he was bang right.
The part of Basil Seal was played by Simon Cadell. Sir Joseph Mannering, Jack May, Lady Seal, Elizabeth Kelly, Angela Lyne, Marion Diamond, Peter Pastmaster, Michael Cochran, Molly, Emma Gregory, Margot Metroland, Mary Wimbush, Ambrose Silk, Steve Hodson, Bentley, Hugh Dixon, Colonel Plum, Nicholas Leprevo, Susie, Zila Clark, Poppet, Joanna Myers, Alistair, Simon Treves, Sonia, Jane Whittenshaw, with Alan Thompson, David King, Timothy Bateson, Danielle Allen, and Timothy Carlton. The narrator was Tony Britton, and the pianist was David King. Evelyn Waugh's Put Out More Flags was dramatized by Dennis Hawthorne and directed by Jane Morgan.